Today, we're going to talk about, we'll continue to talk about the Bhagavad Gita, and I wanted to point out various ways in which it is a type of classical theism. Most people in this part of the world grow up in somewhere within the Judeo-Christian or Islamic tradition. And of course, now there are many Hindus in America, but still, historically, traditionally, American religion is coming from that type of those theistic traditions. So the Bhagavad Gita is, in a sense, a classical theism. It talks about God, and it talks about the soul's relationship with God in ways that are very similar to what people are used to in the biblical traditions. But, of course, not identical. There are certain significant differences. So I want to go over that. I want to go back to the ninth chapter of the Gita, which we didn't really get to talk about. For example, the ninth chapter, text 10, Krishna says that it is by my, literally, supervision, adyaksha, which literally means supervision, by my supervision, the universe is producing all kinds of living beings. This is a type of intelligent design theory. There's a debate going on right now in Western civilization over whether the universe basically is top-down or bottom-up, whether there's some intelligence which guides the development of life, or whether it springs up spontaneously with no intelligent guidance in the process. And the Gita, Krishna says, "Hey, dunanenu kunte jagat viparivarti." The universe, literally the world goes round. The world goes round for this reason, because there is actually this guidance, Krishna says, coming from me. So that's one point. Then, in terms of the ancient Vedic sacrificial culture, Krishna totally, he claims that all of that really is meant to know God. And so there's one interesting statement in chapter 9, text 16, where Krishna says, "I am the ritual, I am the sacrifice, the offering, I am the mantra that's chanted, I am the clarified butter that was offered into the fire, I am the fire, I am the invocation." And so Krishna identifies himself with all the different aspects of the fire sacrifice. And he says all these different components are actually just about me. And it's interesting because Krishna, for a very long time, has been identified with Vishnu, and even in the Vedas, for example, the Yajur Veda, you find statements like this, that the sacrifice indeed is Vishnu, or Vishnu is the sacrifice. So, again, sacrifice means that you come directly into contact with the sacred, or you come directly into contact with God. And so there's an idea going way back, thousands of years of Vedic culture, that somehow the sacrifice is God, or somehow God is present in the sacrifice. So you find this in the Vedas, and you have Krishna explicitly talking about this. And then, of course, something I think I mentioned before, Krishna talks again. He talks about those who, rather than dedicate themselves to devotion, dedicate themselves to the whole sacrificial culture, doing offerings and getting rewards and so on. And Krishna says, "Try the dhyamang soma pa bhuta pa pa." You know Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, people drink soma. All right. People drink soma, and of course he got that from this Vedic culture, so it's this beverage produced at the fire sacrifice. So Krishna talked about the soma pa, the soma drinkers. And he says those who base their activities on the three Vedas and drink the soma, and are purified of their sins in a gross sense, aspiring to heaven. You may remember that in the Mimamsa culture, the people who were just completely head over heels for the fire sacrifice, and their slogan was Swarga Kamo Yajeta, one who desires to go to the material heaven, the sort of the upper class regions of this universe, one who desires to go to that heaven should sacrifice. So Krishna talks about them here. He says, those who aspire to go to that heaven, those who aspire to go to that heaven by sacrifices, Krishna says that they approach the world of Indra, these higher worlds where the gods live. He said they approach these worlds and they actually enjoy, this very sort of poetic statement here, Ashnandi Divyan Divideva Bhogan, which means they, in heaven, they enjoy the celestial pleasures of the gods. So that's the idea. That, for example, say in America or any country, certain people have a lot of money and live in very, very expensive houses, drive very fancy cars, etc., etc. And everybody else kind, well, not everybody else, but there's a lot of people that kind of dream about or watch those people in movies or on television programs, or even, it even gets to the point of reading the magazines they sell at checkout counters. You know, like reading about celebrities. And anyway, having grown up in sort of a celebrity part of Southern California, I'm kind of up to here with this. But anyway, there are a lot of people who, there are a lot of people that really kind of vicariously want to hear about rich people or watch rich people. And so, so the same thing in the Vedic culture, the idea was that for some people the Vedas were just sort of like the sophisticated sacred version of People magazine. In the sense that you can read about all these cosmic celebrities, you know, the gods. That's, what are they but cosmic celebrities? And I don't think I'd like paparazzi. Anyway, where I grew up, there's a lot of paparazzi. So the so it's the same thing. It's the same psychology. If the world you know, if the world you believe in consists of, I don't know, movie stars and or like famous athletes, people who obviously distinguish themselves as among the greatest people who ever lived by their ability to hit balls with bats or kick balls or other invaluable skills. So the idea is that we have different ways of rating people as celebrities and everybody else kind of like wants to hear about them and see them. So if your universe includes gods and goddesses, if you believe that these people actually exist, they are the celebrities, not the human beings. And so you want to go there, just like people nowadays want to go to, you know, they sell star maps. Have you ever been out of Southern California? Yeah, anyway. They sell star maps. Actually, when I was young, I went to UCLA, and it's kind of hilarious because USC, you know, the Trojans, it's a now it's really a good school academically, but when I was young, it was kind of a rich kid school. It was known as that, kind of like, you know, just school for rich kids. And UCLA, of course, is the public university, and so USC was in this terrible neighborhood where, if you're lucky, you'll get your car stolen 3 or 4 times, you know, before you get your bachelor's degree. Anyway, so USC is in this terrible neighborhood. UCLA is in this fabulously wealthy neighborhood where the home prices start around $2 or $3 million, which is kind of ironic because that's the public university. But anyway, I forgot what I was going to say about that. Oh, yeah. So right by, so UCLA. Anyway, the north is Bel Air, and the east is Holmby Hills, and so on. And so they sell these star maps. So when I would go to UCLA every day, you know, I'd pass by all these people in the corner selling star maps. So that same psychology is there with gods and goddesses. Gods and goddesses. So Krishna says people aspire to go to those worlds. But there's a problem. There's a problem here. The problem is, Krishna says, tetam bhutva svargalokam visham, having enjoyed the vast resources of that heavenly world, their piety is exhausted. It's like you work real hard, save all your money, go on some fabulous vacation, spend all your money, you're broke, you're busted, come back home and go to work again. And so that's the idea. That's how the system works according to Hinduism, according to the Vedas. That you work real hard, perform sacrifices, honor different gods and goddesses, follow certain rules, fast, austerities, go through the whole program, you pile up punya points. That's something which is talked about in the book, punya. There are these two opposite words, punya and papa, which roughly mean piety and sin. The pu, by the way, this word is cognate with the English word pure. It kind of means that. So the idea is that, I mean, someone's keeping score up there. That's what karma means. Every time you do a good deed, which could include a morally good deed, a virtuous act, or doing your religious duties, you know, there's a big scoreboard up in the sky, and you get these punya points. And if you do something bad, if you do something harmful to yourself or others, or fail to perform your religious duties, you get a papa point. And And so then at the end, you know, at the end of the day, just look up at the scoreboard. Just do the numbers. And so when you get enough punya points, you get the ultimate collectibles, which are called logas. And not to be confused with the Spanish term. Anyway, loga in Sanskrit means a world, or like a planet. So it's almost like frequent flyer miles, something like frequent sacrificer points or something. So that if you get enough punya points, then you get to go to some heavenly world for a long time and get a celestial body, and people are really beautiful up there and so on. And you can actually pile up, you can actually get a whole bunch of worlds, like these ultimate collectibles, and then you cash in your punya chips. You cash it all in, you know, you redeem your frequent sacrificer points. And then you go up to these higher worlds. And there's all kinds of stories about this, about people doing that. And then, and of course, for all your papa points, then it's the opposite. And that's the system. So Krishna, what Krishna is saying here is this whole system is a little nutty. That's what Krishna is saying. And the reason is, why? Because, well, I'll read you what Krishna says. Because he says, kshine punye, when your piety points are exhausted. In other words, your credit card is on zero. You know, you have no more credit, or you spent all the money you have in the bank. When your little credit account, punya account, is exhausted, Marty Logan Bishop, you have to come back down to the earth and get back to work again. You know, just get out your fire sticks and get the fire going again, start doing good deeds, start. And so Krishna says, Evam Trayi Dharma. So thus, by doing this program, this Vedic program of going up to heaven, all you get for your trouble is a round trip. You go up and you come down. What goes up must come down. Kadagatam karma kalama labhante. Those who are pursuing selfish desire, because that's why people go up there. You don't go up to the heavenly planets just, you know, out of the goodness of your heart. You go there because you want to live in a fabulous celestial world. You can get an incredibly beautiful body and you can enjoy with the gods and do all this really cool stuff. And then when your piety is exhausted, you come crashing back down. There's even one story, one very famous ancient story of a king named Yayati, he's sort of the forefather of all kinds of great kings. In fact, all the kings in the Mahabharata were descended from Yayati. Anyway, it said that he piled up punya points and then cashed them in, went up to these higher worlds, and at a certain point he exhausted his piety and committed some offenses because he'd become proud, even offended Indra. At a certain point, Indra just told him, all right, back down you go. And meanwhile, Yayati's ancestors, his other kings who were descendants of Yayati, they're out of some sacrificial ground piling up their punya points. And they see this, like, this bright, effulgent figure just, like, literally floating down from the higher worlds. And, oh my God, that's our ancestor Yayati. So he just comes floating down from the higher worlds back down to Earth. And they say, like, hey, you know, what happened to you? And he explains, I went up there, but I had to come back down. Anyway, so that's the idea. That's how the system works. It's just this cosmic economy. You work hard, you put assets into your punya account, you cash them in, you enjoy life. You go back to work again. And Krishna's saying, this is futile, because you just keep going around and around and around. And that's the sense of what samsara is. And even Buddha, the James talked about this sort of futile going round and round and round, and you never really get a permanent position. You never get a real home. You never have permanent relationships. You know, it's like people have certain kinds of emotional disorders, and they can't stay in relationships, or they can't commit to anything. And so Krishna is saying that you should search for something which you can keep, which is permanent, which is really you. Because even if you take a celestial body, even if you get, let's say, the body of a god or goddess, it's still not really you. It's just a very sophisticated covering of the eternal soul. And so the conclusion is that our real home is not in this universe. Even in fact, Krishna will say, I think earlier in the Gita, that Abrahma Bhuvanaloka Punaravartino Arjuna, that from the highest planet in the universe, which is the planet of the Creator, Brahma, down Brahmaloka, down to these earthly worlds, it's all temporary. There's no permanent position in the universe, because in fact the whole universe is temporary. There, I think in physics now or astronomy, have the idea of the expanding universe, which is also what we get in the ancient Vedas, actually, the idea that the universes come out, they expand, and at a certain point they're withdrawn again. So the universe, the whole universe is temporary, according to this view, not to speak of a particular body you get in the world. So that's sort of a very central point in these devotional traditions. Actually, it's a central point even in Buddhism and Jainism. Of course, there's different strategies on how to deal with this. But everyone agrees. All these sort of, you could say, spiritual traditions in India, the Buddhists, the Jains, the Bhakti movements, the Vedanta movements, everyone agrees that an intelligent people, that an intelligent person doesn't want junk. It's just like, you know, if you buy a car and it's quote-unquote junk, and then you, I saw this funny thing on YouTube, someone sent it to me. Anyway, it was like this real junky car, a person drives off the lot, the whole thing just disintegrates before his eyes. So, what a junk, you don't want a junky car, or a junky computer, or a junky relationship. And so, the idea is that intelligent people want to go beyond this and find something permanent. And that's really the spirit of, actually, spiritual movements throughout the world, not only in India. The idea is to find a permanent situation. There's a certain bravado among certain people, like, well, I don't care about that, I'm not afraid of death. And people usually say that until they actually get terminal illnesses. But what's interesting about that attitude, like, I don't care if I have to die, it doesn't matter to me. It seems to me, logically, not religiously now, but just on the basis of logic, that if you don't see it as a very negative value to lose something, it must not have been a very positive value to have it. In other words, it seems to me the more you value something, the more you don't want to lose it. And the more you really are kind of cavalier about it, like, I don't care. I don't care if I lose that. It seems to me the more someone is like that, I don't see how they could really value it so much. It seems like there's something really logically impossible there. To say that I really value, you know, I'd say in a relationship, I really value you, I really think this relationship is very important, and I really couldn't care less if we break up. It just seems like, wait a second, what did you say? So, people that say, I don't care if I have to die. It seems that people that say that, I wonder like how much they really value life. I don't see how you can say both things and have it be logically consistent. So, sometimes there's an interpretation that people who are concerned in any religion, because you find this in practically all religions, people who are seriously concerned with finding eternal, finding something permanent, they're just kind of pessimistic and negative. I mean, it's like, I mean, let's say if someone has a really bad, serious illness and their friend says, you better go to a doctor. No, that's just pessimistic. Like, why should I? I don't have to deal with this. It's not pessimistic. It's like, hello, you have a serious disease. And so in the same way, to say that it's pessimistic just to open your eyes and not be in denial about the fact that, you know, earthly life is going to end and somewhat in the near future, because it actually doesn't take that long to go through a life. And so, to say that that's somehow pessimistic, just to open your eyes and see what's really happening, is, I think, not quite lucid. And so, one could argue that people who are concerned with the eternal are the ones who most value life. And that's why they don't want to lose it. They're actually seriously concerned about extending life in whatever religion they're in, or just whatever wisdom tradition they're in. I mean, just whatever, however they conceive of extending life. It seemed to me it's the people who value life. I mean, if you value something, it seems you want to keep it. Like if someone says, hey, why don't you fix your car? No, it's just a piece of junk. I'm going to get rid of it anyway. I mean, someone that is not really seriously concerned about extending their life is either A, I think, in deep denial about their own mortality, or B, just may not care that much about it. So I think there's something... anyway... And I think these are just logical points, unless someone can show how it's not. I mean, it just seems to me this is like simple logic. So if you value something, you want to keep it. Anyway, so the Gita, like basically almost every other spiritual tradition, has some concern with, or a serious concern with, permanence. Then, let's see. Oh yeah. There's a misconception about these traditions, these quote-unquote Eastern traditions, as if they're all the same, that it's like whatever you do, you get the same result. Like, it doesn't matter what you do, because whatever you do, it gives the same result anyway. And not that no one teaches that, but the Gita doesn't teach that. For example, let's say you went to the airport. Let's say you went to the airport in Orlando and bought a ticket for New York, and the plane went to Chicago. Or let's say then you bought a ticket for Los Angeles, and the plane went to Chicago. And you bought a ticket for Puerto Rico, and the plane went to Chicago. At a certain point, it's like whatever ticket you buy, they keep sending you to Chicago. It gets into an issue of free will. Like, do you have free will? Are you allowed to go where you want to go? And so what we can observe is that people are doing very different things. People have very different objectives in life. And so to say that people with very different objectives in life, pursuing very different goals, all end up in the same place, it's that would seem to indicate that people's own wishes are irrelevant. Like somehow the way the universe is set up, it's irrelevant what you actually want, or what you're pursuing, because it all comes out the same anyway. So the Gita's doctrine is one of free will, that you actually have freedom. And therefore, in this chapter 9, we'll never get past chapter 9 day at this rate. Anyway, Krishna says in chapter 9, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan. Literally, those who are devoted, little linguistic note, in case anyone's just interested in comparative linguistics, Sanskrit word is Vrata, and you just drop the R, it becomes the Latin. Sort of both of, you know about historical linguistics, vowels kind of are very unstable, all over the place. It's the consonants that are more sort of that last longer. Anyway, so Rata is Sanskrit, take out the word VR, it's just a Latin voto, and then in Latin de voto means by a vow. I mean, the same as the English word vote, obviously, or vow, or votary. And you get the word devotee, or devoto in Latin, which just means someone who's vowed to something, someone who has committed themselves to something, to be devoted. So, anyway, Sanskrit Vrata, and that's the word Krishna uses. So, he says, Janti Deva Vrata Devan. Those who are devoted to the gods will go to the gods. And those who are devoted to the forefathers or the ancestors, not all, it's also just four mothers, so the ancestors, those who are devoted to the ancestors will go to the ancestors. Those who are devoted to, what else we got here on the menu? Those two sort of ethereal spirits, you know, like spirit worship. They go to the spirits. And then Krishna says, and those who are dedicated to me will come to me. So it's a doctrine of freedom, of individual freedom, that you basically get, you know, whatever button you push, that's what you get. Now, the idea that you get whatever you... that whatever you do, you get the same result. You could arguably say that it would be true in this sense. Let's say, according to the Bhagavad Gita, I think you could argue that according to the Bhagavad Gita, all the people in the world who sincerely are trying to approach God, you know, however they understand that, with a capital G, I mean, all people in the world who believe there is something like an absolute truth, there is something like a supreme being, and they're trying to find that, all those people, if they're sincere, will eventually kind of get there. But as we can see, there are many people, especially in California where I'm from, anyway, there are many people who their concept of spirituality has nothing to do with God. It's often, I know, for example, I was... spent some time up in the mountains north of Ventura, California. There's a very trendy, popular little mountain town there called Ojai, California. Which is, it's a very, and there's all kinds of, there's a lot of interest in yoga and Eastern things, and it's, trying to avoid the word New Agey, but anyway, there's a lot of that stuff there. It's sort of famous for that. I know Arnold, governor, you know, he just bought a house there. So, anyway, so it's interesting because I was noticing that town. I was on a writing retreat in that town, and I was noticing that, like, you go to the natural food store. There's a big bulletin board, community bulletin board, and there's like hundreds of advertisements for all kinds of programs. And I noticed there's almost like zero about, let's say, God. Which, of course, everyone has a right to do what they want, but there was very little interest in what we would normally associate with sort of, you know, God, religion. And almost all of it was about the body. It was about what sort of like different alternative mystic ways to deal with your body and to make your body beautiful, to make your body, which is a good thing. I mean, I'm not in favor of ugliness or illness, but in fact, I was discussing that with some people, and so what I mean to say is that there are many people who do have interest in mystical things and in what they consider to be even spiritual things, but really have very little interest in anything like God. I mean, however you understand that. And so therefore, I think according to the Gita, those who have a serious, sincere interest in God, however they understand that, just the general notion that there is some highest truth, there is some absolute truth, there is some power in the universe, perhaps personal, which ultimately is the source of our existence and which somehow is responsible for the universe as it now is. According to the Gita, those people kind of end up, you know, they'll make it eventually. Those who pursue something else will basically get what they want. Any questions on that? I'm trying to faithfully explain what's in the Gita. Then there is in this ninth chapter, there's an expression of the equality that God is sort of like an equal opportunity employer, in the sense that Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 9:29, Samoham Sarvabhutesha, I'm equal to all creatures, I don't favor anyone. There are some theologies that God, for reasons known only to himself, chooses certain people to be saved, other people aren't saved. But here we have a statement from Krishna that he's equal to everyone. There's no favoritism. That we're not dealing with a jealous God or a God that just doesn't like certain people or whatever. It's a God who's absolutely equal to everyone. Almost like a good parent would say to their children, I love all my children equally. I mean, parents are known to say things like that to their children. So, in a sense, here's a statement from Krishna in that line. Also, the power of devotion, here's something else which is found in many devotional religions, whether it's East or West, and that is the power of devotion, and in a sense of the power of devotion to bring about redemption. So we have a statement which sounds like statements in other religions, that api chet suduracharo bhajate mam ananyapa, even if someone has is a very bad behavior. In other words, someone has behaved very badly in some way. If that person, devotes themselves fully to me, to God, then sadhariva samantabhyasa, that person, having come to the right understanding, is again accepted as a saintly person or a good person. The idea is that punishment is not intended to be vindictive or malicious, that the purpose of punishment is actually to improve people, to make them better persons, to somehow benefit them, and not simply to punish them for the sake of punishment. And therefore, if someone has, let's say, misbehaved, but has redeemed themselves and actually come to the proper consciousness, there's no further benefit in punishing them, because they've actually come to the right understanding. And this is possible through the power of devotion, according to the Gita. God, that was just chapter 9. It was just a small part of chapter 9. Yes?
So relative to the last statement that we made about how if you worship demigods, you go to demigods, and you worship the ancestors. I might be wrong, but isn't there a statement somewhere in the Gita that says that Krishna says no matter who you worship, you're really only worshiping me?
Yeah, there is a statement actually where Krishna says that those who worship the gods are actually worshiping the supreme God, but aditi purvakam, which means irregularly. The idea being that the gods themselves represent the supreme God, but to worship a god as an as if that God were supreme, is in a sense indirectly worshiping God. But it's interesting because there are traditions in the world that claim that the gods don't exist at all. They're dead. I mean, they just don't exist. There was a controversy in one of the early communities, which was founded by Paul of Tarsus. And it was a controversy, and we know about the controversy because of a letter Paul wrote, which is in the New Testament. It was a controversy over dietary restrictions. And dietary restrictions, like, you know, what are you allowed to eat, was a hot issue because the Jesus movement was still considered to be a Jewish movement. In fact, it was known to everyone in the world. It's just because Judaism was much more diverse than now. And so in Judaism, they have these dietary restrictions, these kosher laws. And so Paul was trying to differentiate his community and show that we are different, we are distinct. We don't have to follow all the Jewish laws because Jesus has, in a sense, established a new covenant. Covenant being a contract. Contract consists of, you know, stipulations, rules. And so there's a new contract, there's a new covenant. We don't have to follow the old contract. And so in his enthusiasm or his determination to differentiate these two traditions, he basically waived all the dietary restrictions and sort of bragged about his the fact that he would eat anything. And so a controversy arose because someone wrote to him and said in a particular community there was a dispute within the community. They were fighting because the people liked to eat meat. And the only meat you could find in the marketplace was offered to the gods, because that was the nature of pagan culture. You couldn't find meat that was just, you know, secular meat. If you wanted to buy meat, you had to buy meat offered to the gods. And so some people refused to eat the meat because they said, well, that's, you know, we're not going to eat the meat offered to the gods because they're just evil or don't exist anyway. There's something evil about that. And other people said, well, the gods don't exist. There are no such things as gods. And so what's the problem? You know, just get into your Big Mac. So they wrote to Paul about this, and Paul wrote back and said, the people that say the gods don't exist, there are no such things, they're actually right, they don't exist. And however, because we don't want to, you know, bother other people in the community, maybe just, you know, don't buy that meat for now. But the point is that the notion that the gods don't exist, and that there's something evil about it, there's all kinds of... many early Christians actually gave their lives in horrific ways, like having to walk into stadiums and be, you know, eaten by lions, or just all kinds of really horrible things, because they felt that there was something evil and demonic about the notion of other gods, and that to they were somehow it was like this absolute dualism between perfect good and perfect evil, and somehow the very notion of the other gods was a threat to the supreme God, it was evil, and so on. And on the Indian side, they had a very different take on this. And the take was that there is, it shows in the Bhagavad Gita, there is a supreme God, there's no problem with that, and what we call the gods are assistants. They're simply people like us who have achieved high positions by their own piety and now serve God. Just as we are serving God, they're also serving God. So this notion that these creatures were something, if they exist, they don't exist, but if they did, they'd be evil, is a very different way of looking at things. In India, they had a different notion of this. Yes?
Why did the Christians feel so strongly about that with the first commandment? It just seems a little weird to me. I mean, I knew that they were killed, I just thought it was because it wasn't their choice, but they practiced Christianity, so they were killed because they just thought that the pagan gods were so evil that the idea of more than one god was really...
I don't want to justify the Roman government because they were a little out of control too. But scholars do admit that the Roman world, which extended, of course, throughout Europe and North Africa and the Near East and so on, I mean, that huge Roman world was more tolerant and more respectful of other religions before it became Christian. And when it did become Christian, it introduced this new idea. Things became less tolerant, and in that sense, you know, sort of like it was justified to kill someone if they are preaching a false doctrine. So you have sort of this, I mean, there's something very, again, sorry for the term, but just to save time, New Agey, about the Roman Empire. The Roman conception of religion was, I mean, in terms of, was basically this, that there is a divine power in the universe, and there are many channels to divine power. And you can't get too much divine power. The Romans were all about power. And so whenever they would come across another religion, they thought, well, if you have a channel to that divine power, we will literally buy into it. So the Roman emperor would make monthly or whatever, regularly donations to religions throughout the empire, including to the temple in Jerusalem before it was destroyed, to have worship performed in the name of the emperor so that the Roman government could get the blessings of all these different manifestations of divine power. And if you look at India, in other words, linguistically, proto-historically, there is such a thing as an Indo-European civilization. And when we look at this Indo-European civilization, in other words, European civilization going way back into pagan times, and the ancient Indian civilization, what's interesting is that in both cases, there's often a type of religious tolerance, there is an understanding, or there is a belief in the presence of the divine, the presence of God in many different places, and that there are different ways to approach God. And I think that this is not a coincidence. This is not a coincidence, I think, that in India and Europe, these are also the two places where you get the major philosophical developments in the world. When Buddhism went to China, China certainly had wisdom traditions, but in terms of systematic, comprehensive philosophy, as we now understand it, it actually came with Buddhism to China. Similarly, the Islamic civilization preserved, Greek philosophers like Aristotle, who's very famous, that a lot of the most important intellectual and philosophical developments during the golden age of Islam were based on the study and analysis of Greek philosophy. So in terms of civilizations that independently developed comprehensive, very sophisticated, categorical, systematic, philosophical traditions, we find that especially in India and in Europe, the Indo-European civilization, I think it's not a coincidence that these more philosophically minded civilizations also developed strong doctrines of religious tolerance and a sense of the oneness of... Because after all, if you don't have philosophy, all you've got is a story, a specific historical event, like God came down, or the Son of God, or the Prophet, or the Goddess, or whatever. There's a specific historical event that took place one time, and there's one person with this name in that place that did these things, and that's what it's about. But when you become philosophical, you can think, wait a second, let's talk about the abstract category, incarnation. Or let's talk about Son of God not as a unique, like only one person, but let's talk about the philosophical or metaphysical category, a Son of God. And, you know, can sons of God or daughters of God appear in many places? Is that a type of being, a class of beings, a group of beings, rather than just one specific, particular historical event? So, in fact, in terms of cognitive development, it's the ability to move from the specific to the general, to the abstract, to the categorical, that basically makes one a rational human being. In other words, if you, let's say, saw a horse, and you just thought, my God, what is that thing? And then you saw another one, oh my God, what is that? And you never really developed the category horse, or mammal, or quadruped, or living creature. In other words, you have no abstract categories in your head, you only have specific things. You can see that you're not going to become the deepest thinker in the world. And so it's specifically in those traditions that took philosophy more seriously, that they developed, like the Vedanta, this notion that there is a oneness, there is a one God, it can manifest like this, like that, and the other way, rather than a type of tribal approach, like, you know, if you think about it, our tribe, it's like, this is our tribe, and you're the enemy, the other, you're the other tribe. And you take that psychological structure and just impose it on religion, on world religions. So there are the good religious tribes and the bad religious tribes. And the good ones should do away with the bad ones. So this type of non-philosophical tribal thinking, I think, has been a serious problem in world history. So, yes?
I have a separate question.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Is the material world set up in this way with our absolute free will, we could actually use this stuff forever?
According to the Gita, you mean? You could be stuck forever going around in the material world? It's interesting. I think that the idea you get from these literatures is that eventually people learn, because no one is that dumb. I mean that's the idea, I think, that gives them literature, that eventually, given, you know, sort of, I guess, a sufficient number of experiences, that someone will eventually get it. Yes.
I just want to say, like, you're saying about the gods and stuff, it's like, you're saying that these gods exist, but like, how do we know, like, they look like that?
Oh, yeah, now, I'm saying the Gita says they exist. How do we know they look like that? Take the history of European art, just to give an example. And let's say, for example, you took all the, like, from the early Renaissance schools or just even medieval schools of art. If you trace the history of European art all the way to the present day, and let's say you looked at the way European artists depicted the human anatomy or mountains or something like that. And you can see it goes through all kinds of different periods, you know, a somewhat crude, somewhat flat style, then to the Renaissance, much more emphasis on realism. And then you get into abstract schools and this and that, the other thing. The point is, every historical age of art, every historical age kind of like imposes upon its objects its own way of thinking. And yet, you couldn't conclude that therefore mountains don't exist and the human anatomy doesn't exist. In other words, even though every artist kind of, you know, gives their version of a mountain of anything, to conclude, therefore, mountains don't exist. This is the argument given by, I think I might have explained this earlier, Xenophanes. He was a pre-Socratic philosopher who, I think, thought he really was delivering a knockout punch to personal theism. When he said that, that if we look at Greek pictures of gods, the gods and goddesses, they look like Greeks, and the Egyptian gods and goddesses look like Egyptians. And everywhere you go in the world, the gods and goddesses look like those people. People, I mean, you've seen that probably, even like little pamphlets you get, like there's a Scandinavian, you know, buff Jesus, that, you know, certain people give out those pamphlets, and there's other, I mean, you see Jesus depicted in many, with many different races and sizes according to the people that are depicting it. And so, but that doesn't mean you can conclude it doesn't exist. I mean, not on that basis. Xenophanes said, therefore, if ox and lions and horses had arms and hands and drew pictures, you'd find gods looking like ox or horses or lions. But to say that we see things through our own filter doesn't mean necessarily things don't exist. The fact that Greek gods look like Greeks and Egyptian gods look like Egyptians, you could say that, you know, Egyptians have their own way of painting mountains and Greeks have a different way of painting mountains. You couldn't conclude from that mountains don't exist. So as far as what gods and goddesses look like, well, let me know when you get there. But I'm only saying that when we make our decision, like whatever we choose to believe on this, it should be on reasonable grounds, not based on sort of silly arguments that don't hold water. And I don't think it's intrinsically evil to be a celestial being that somehow serves God. And I don't think that, there could be such a person who is evil, but I don't think that alone is evil, to say that that in the universe some people are greater than human beings and they serve God. I don't think that in and of itself is evil. Anything else on that? Paul associated, one more point since we're on this theme. there was a tendency back in that world, say in the Middle East, and also in cultures influenced by Middle Eastern thought, to equate, there was a real hostility toward the worship of visible images, which is really the heart of Hinduism. And even Buddhism, for that matter, they have their own little idols too. And to associate this with polytheism, it gets into an ontological point, as we discussed with Vedanta. In other words, it gets into a if someone says that the divine, whether it's a god or goddess, whatever, can or cannot appear in a physical object, let's say like a figurine or some kind of deity form, it depends on what you believe to be the status of matter. You know, like matter, you know, just what we generally call dead matter, like your shirt. What is the status of matter? What is matter, ultimately? And so, is it possible that matter could be a vehicle for a divine manifestation, or is there something intrinsically so nasty and disgusting about matter that it can never be an appropriate vehicle for the manifestation of divine power? Because there's something just so intrinsically corrupt and horrible about it. So, again, in the philosophical traditions, I would say, I mean, certainly in Indo-European civilization, and including pagan Europe, which was actually very similar to the Vedic civilization in many ways, in Indo-European civilization, they would say that matter is ultimately not evil. That matter is ultimately a divine energy of God, and therefore, and the problem is that if we misuse it, if we exploit matter, it becomes a problem. But if matter is used spiritually, it manifests as a divine energy of God, and therefore can be an appropriate vehicle for the manifestation of divine power, the manifestation of God. Because matter intrinsically is not evil. It's actually an energy of God. So underlying different debates about the status, like can you... I mean, even in the Old Testament, God appears in a burning bush. So, these are really at the heart of certain differences in the way civilizations have looked at religion. And it gets, underlying it is, what do you think matter is? It gets down to a philosophical issue. It's like whether or not you study psychology, you have one. Every one of us has a psychology. And so if someone says, well, I don't study psychology, therefore I don't have a psychology. Well, you do. If you study psychology, you may understand your psychology. So whether or not someone studies philosophy, everyone has a philosophy. And so therefore we can look at what is the philosophical basis for certain claims, such as God cannot appear within a material object, or that God can appear in a material object. What's the underlying philosophy which says that the notion that there are certain souls in the universe who are more powerful than us and that assist God, that this is evil? I mean, what's the underlying idea here? So that, anyway, time's up. Now, that's one point I wanted to bring out in this course, is that to try to approach these things sort of in a reasonable philosophical sense and see what's really behind different ideas. So, we'll see you on Friday.